I would like to speak of one or two cameras that are alive or dead now. I will not speak of Heinrich Blume, one of the closest collaborators of the Führer, born in 1870 and 87, that is to say 2 years before him, on the day, on the very day Frederick the Great was born, that is to say 24th of January. I spoke of him in pilgrimage. He was a wonderful man. Wonderful man. He was what you call Oberregierungs- und Rat, Oberregierungs- und Schulrat, under the, sort of like it. But I speak of people that I met myself in Germany. One is Gerda Strasstadt. Gerda Strasstadt I met in the Anna Stift Hospital in 56. They told me about her. Frau Manicke, one friend of mine, Frau Manicke, told me about her. Frau Manicke herself was a wonderful person, real National Socialist. She must be dead now. She would be, I don't know how old. She was much older than I. And she gave me this address. She said, this girl suffered for us, suffered for the cause. And she did. I met her in a room. She had one arm completely cut off, one leg completely cut off, and half the other leg too. She had, in fact, one arm, the right one, fortunately. And she told me she was reading Gold in the Furnace. She knew English. She was 31 at that time, but she looked 21 or 22. She looked much younger than her age, in spite of all that. Pretty face, brunette. And she liked my book. I said, good dear me, Gerda, you speak of Gold in the Furnace. I only wrote it. It's the title of a book of mine. But you are Gold in the Furnace. This is how she happened to go into that state. She was caught by the British police after the war. She had been the secretary of a very top man, National Socialist. And she was asked to tell the names and the hiding places of that man and of several others. She knew where they were. She refused to speak. They kicked her, knocked her about, they beat her, they knocked her to all her teeth, and they put her into such a state, without her speaking, that even the men who did it could not help admiring her. But the result was, and then she went to a camp, naturally, a concentration camp, of the Allies. That was 46, 5, 40, early 47, after that treatment, her limbs were gangrenous out of the beatings. And they had to cut off one arm, and then another leg, and half the other leg. Because she was in the state of an unfortunate insect that would have been pulled to pieces by naughty children. And still she was smiling. I admired that woman so much. I saw her later on once at her brother's. She had been discharged from this hospital where she stayed for days and days and months. And she was living with her brother and her sister-in-law in, I don't remember the place, Zeilerstrasse, I think, in Hanover. This was in Hanover. And now this is one among thousands. There must be thousands like her. Another one is Olga von Barigny, who lived in Bohemia during the war. She's married to a German of what they call Czechoslovakia, and it's the Bohemia. She calls herself von Barigny because it's her maiden name. Her father is from Hungary and her mother German, or reverse, I don't know. She was a writer, she is still a writer. If she's alive, she was very, very ill lately. I don't know, I've not written to her yet. I'm going to write to her for the summer, for the winter solstice, and I'll have news. She wrote, among others, three very impressive books. Der Prager Totentanz, The Death Dance of Prague. der tote Briefkasten und das tote Geleise. There are three books, one about the happenings in Prague 1945, one about the happenings in Prague later on, and one about what the happenings in München in our very days, how communist propaganda goes on in München, and how things happen without people knowing why and where. Very interesting books. The first one, of course, is Shuddering. It tells you about Czech youth, communist youth, sworn to do as much harm as possible to the Germans after the war, and what they did. Things that Olga saw with her own eyes, things that she put up with her own body. She was caught by the communists and tortured. She showed me her back. Her back is one wound. Red hot iron was applied to it to make her speak, and she did not speak. And she told me, it's awful the first 2 or 3 minutes. And then, of course, one doesn't get accustomed to the red hot iron. But one gets a kind of defiant spirit. Some force comes into one, she said. And one feels, I've stood it until now, I'll stand it to the end. A sort of strange force that comes from elsewhere. But she said, and I can understand this very well, if they had tried this on my dog in front of me, instead of trying it on me, I don't know what I would have done. I can understand that. And she told me that these kind of things happened as a very, I would say, very ordinary piece of happening in Prague in those days. She told me about children, German children, 131 of them, taken from a hospital and walled in. They put them in a room, shut the door, walled. They died of suffocation, of course. But after so many hours, after what torture, nobody knows what. Babies and little children, little girls 2 or 3 years old, with their, holding their doll in their arms. She told me, and she told it, she put it in her Prager Totentanz also, that awful story of people burnt alive, hung to the lampposts and a fire under them. A young soldier, an old woman, only because they were Germans. She told me of that young SS man, 17 or 18, quite young, tied to a table in a cinema of Prague with all the people around him, Czechs. And next to him were a pair of scissors and a knife and a container full of vinegar. And every one of the people had to go there, cut a slice off him, and pour vinegar into the wound. Cut it off with a pair of scissors or with a knife and pour vinegar in him, until he died. Things like that make you ashamed of being white, not Aryan. I don't say Czechs are. Czechs may be Aryan. They are Slavs. Whatever they are a white race. You can imagine the Chinese and say, you speak of the horrors of the Chinese tortures and things like that. You can imagine that it coming on in ancient China, at the most in ancient time, not even in today's China, or in ancient Korea, where it was a feat in the 19th century, a great betterment that no longer prisoners had the knees crushed to pieces, which was a torture that they had before. They lifted it up, they suppressed it in the 19th century. It was supposed to be a great betterment. But when you hear this happening in 1945, it makes you ashamed of having two legs and being a human being. So it makes me feel. Animals would not do things like that. Another thing which I find also awful in the Prager Totentanz is the treatment of the animals because they belong to Germans. For instance, young boys and girls, chicks, poking out the eyes of poor German horses because they were Wehrmacht horses. A Czech trying to forbid that. A Czech with one Czech and a kind heart, couldn't bear that on animals, tried to stop it. They did it to him. They killed him. And the girl who killed him was a girl. She had 180 written on front of, in front of her breast. And she put it, took out the zero and put 181. It meant that she had killed 181 Germans to herself. They would take a dog, bring that dog to a heap of corpses. Now you look for your master. The poor dog would look for his master in whimpering. And he would finish by pulling out the corpse of an SS man killed by the Czechs. Oh, you are the dog of an SS man. Pour boiling water over him. Things like that. Cut off the paws of poor cats because they belong to Germany. This, I feel so much for this that I feel that Prague should be wiped out. Completely wiped out. By the Russians, by the Chinese, by the Americans, by whoever you like, by extraterrestrials, I don't care by whom, but a place in which such things happened. 150,000 Germans and so many animals tortured to death in 1945, this place which doesn't deserve to live. That's my opinion. And when I heard of the Russians behaving as they did in 56, I think, no, when was it in Prague? In the 60s. I said, well, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. They were their glorious allies. The Russians had not entered Prague yet. They feasted them when they came. They were their glorious allies. Well, you couldn't care less if they squashed them under their tanks. What had they done? What had they done? I tell you, this makes me sometimes sick of being not a white person, but a human being. Why don't I have four legs and a tail and stripes all over my body, beautiful fur? Why am I not a tigress? Tigresses are much better than that. More beautiful, first of all. And then they don't do such things. They are people. People with eyes and nose and mouth. People looking like me and looking like you. Looking people. And did these things. And I say, it's no wonder they did these things. Because if they can do what they do to the SEALs in Canada, to the SEALs who are nothing to them, who never had an ideology, who cannot have one, who can neither be for nor against any ideology, all the more they can do it to Germans, or to communists, or to fascists, or to anything in East, anything that has an ideology, or that is supposed to have one. You mean to say the German children had no ideology? Certainly not. But the Czechs would think, oh, they are the Germans. Their parents had one. They will have one when they grow up. They will be our enemies. It's a different thing. It's a different degree of cowardice to do an awful thing to an animal that cannot be for nor against anything, and to do it even to a child that can be for or against something, against anything, when it grows up. There's a degree of cowardice. They are both awful things, both coward actions. And I believe that cowardice is the ugliest vice on earth. You cannot be cruel unless you are coward. Fighting is not bad. Fighting honestly. But fighting in a sneaking way and fighting in doing cruelties, that's cowardice. Cowardice is the worst thing. It's the most despicable vice I can imagine. I'd much rather have some other vices. Laziness. Laziness is not good, but it's better than that. All the other vices are better than that. That's the father of vices. Lying is a mark of cowardice. If you can lie, it means to say that you don't want to face the consequences of what you have done or of what you believe. So you rather lie. You're not a liar if you're not a coward. You have to be a coward to have other vices. You have to be a coward. Now, what I'm going to say about Olga von Varenius, thought of Gerda Strasser, yes. I could talk of Frau Manicke. She died in her bed, as far as I know. But she was such a good national socialist. Really. and so kind to all the others. Any National Socialist could go to her and in her house in Hanover and get shelter there, stay there as long as he liked. She would give introductions to him, she would give him, help him to get a job, she would do everything. She had secret meetings in her house, up to 100, 150 people. I went to some in the years 50, 51, 52, up to 60. The last time I saw her was in 71. She was there. Now, I speak not of great martyrs of National Socialism or great people, but very ordinary people. There was a girl called Brigitte Wagner in Germany. She was about 18 in 71. And she was introduced to me by another very great National Socialist, Hans Elbing. Hans Elbing is a wonderful man. He introduced me to her. There was her, it was her birthday, in fact. And Herr Elbing and Frau Elbing and Manfred, what's he called? Meinhard. Meinhard Elbing, who is a young boy, was a young boy then, he must be a great young man now. We all went to the birthday party. After the birthday party, Brigitte called me to her room. And in her room, I saw a beautiful portrait of herself, life size, head and breast. I said, Brigitte, you are as beautiful on your picture as you are in reality. She was engaged to a young National Socialist of Flanders. She must be married now and probably a mother. And she said, well, that's not what I want to show you. She pulled that picture out. And behind that picture, there was a beautiful picture of the Führer. She said, that's wonderful. And you have this in your room? She said, yes. In the daytime, I put my picture in front. Because the jar woman comes, this one comes, that one comes. My schoolmates, she was going to college, my schoolmates come. They can't see it because it'll put my parents into trouble. But otherwise, we all understand each other. And to you, I can show it. The youngest National Socialist I met in Germany in 71 was 5 years old. Not even quite 5. I can see him still. Heiligler Tante, putting up his arm. And there are several families in which this salutation is still, I mean to say, pronounced. Not to everybody, of course, to those in whom they can have confidence. They have learnt, the German people have learnt, as far as I know, to be as silent as Japanese, to hold their tongues. That's the lesson, the great lesson they learned since 45, to hold their tongues. In 48, I was in a family, and I was talking to the father of the family, who had 3 children. Well, one was the child of his wife, a widow who lost her husband in Russia. He fell on the field of honor in Russia, and he married her and gave her 2 other children. There were therefore 3. The little boy was about 6, and he used to go to school. And I was deploring that the school was only 1 hour a day in those days. And the father told me, well, 1 hour a day, because they have dismissed every National Socialist that was a teacher, and they put teachers who are not National Socialists. And that makes that one teacher has 4,000, 5,000 pupils, and they can only take them 1 hour a day, and that with difficulty. As I said that, the little boy interrupted me and said, Aber, Herr Blücher ist genauso Nazi wie wir. Herr Blücher was his teacher. Herr Blücher is just as much as a National Socialist as we are all. And he got such a slap from his father, or his stepfather. He became as red as a peony. And I felt sorry for him. I said to his father, why do you beat him like that? Poor child. He didn't mean anything bad. And the father said, yes, but he must learn his lesson. He tells that to you. He tells you that Herr Blücher is a National Socialist, which is probably true. And it doesn't matter, you are one too. But he'll tell somebody else tomorrow. He'll tell Tom, Dick and Harry. And we'll all get into trouble, and Herr Blücher will get into trouble. So he has to keep quiet. He has to learn to keep quiet. And then he looked onto the boy. The boy had not cried, not wept. He took it without saying a word. A brave little boy, worthy of his father, fallen in Russia. And he said, well, Gerald, do you understand this now? Do you understand this? Do you understand that I gave you a slap? Because you deserved it. And Gerald said, yes, I do. That's the spirit. That's the spirit. You have that spirit in Germany. And I can say one thing. I admire Germany in the person of the few National Socialists I met there, and how many is one to meet, more than I did in 1935. 1935, I heard of all this enthusiasm. I was in India, and I used to say, well, one day I'll go back to Europe, one day I'll perhaps be able to tell the Führer that I'm bringing him the alliance of the elite of India. That was all right. There was an atmosphere. But in 48, among the ruins, and I saw something as ruins. Hamburg was worse a ruin than Babylon. I've seen the ruins of Babylon, and I can tell you, they are less ruins than Hamburg was in 1948. It was charred walls, nothing but charred walls, and nobody in the streets, black streets. One platform in the station instead of 28. And in 53, there were 28 again, and there was a town. Wonderful. I was more happy to see that resurrected Hamburg than it was of anything else. I said, where did they get that courage? Where did they get that stamina? They are invincible. And then, not only Hamburg, Nuremberg. Nuremberg has been reconstructed practically as it was. Thanks to boys and girls who, under the bombs, would go to the tops of the buildings and take the measurements in order to reconstruct them after the war. They did it during the war. And now you get Nuremberg growing out. Well, it doesn't look like the old Nuremberg, of course, because it is not centuries ago since it has been built. But in centuries to come, it will look the same, or more or less. At least they did what they could. The principal Markt of Münster, in which, I'm sorry to say, but this is something that is very disturbing to me, in which in 1536, Jan van Leyden, Knut per Dolling, Kritting, the three heads of the Wiedertaufer, what you call it, Anabaptist, were tortured to death in front of 10,000 people. This I say because I detest these foreign creeds that set Germans against Germans, Aryans against Aryans, for some quibble, something to do with some ideology that is not even European. I hate that. Anyhow, that happened. And under this principal Markt, under the footpath, there are 10,000 people now, due to the bombardment, all buried alive under there. Descendants of those who watched them. And the principal Markt has been reconstructed. The houses with these slanting roofs and gables on that, it's all there, just as it was. Just as it was. And so many other towns, they have done their best. It's wonderful to see Germany in 48. I couldn't come back till 53. There was only 5 years between the two. And in 5 years, I saw such wonders. And the spirit growing. I'll tell you that another time. I haven't got this text in front of me. But in 53, when was it? Yes, in 53, before I went back to Germany, I stayed for some time in Greece. And it was the birthday of a camarade that I met in Vienna. So-called war criminal, Hertha Ehlert, living in Bad Homburg now, if she's alive. She's my age, 6 months older. She's born on the 26th of March, 1905. It was the 26th of March, and I was in Athens. I was free. She, poor thing, she was in Wales still. She only came out later. And I went into a place where you get yogurt and you can eat cakes and things like that. I had something to eat there. And it came to me, I thought of Hertha, I thought of her, and it came to me to write this poem. I don't know if I'll be able to say it in entirety, but I'll try. And time rolls on, and every empty day that slowly fades away, as uneventful as any other one into the mist of unrecorded history, brings us along our strenuous way, nearer the heart's desire of the revengeful, nearer the doom of those whom we resist, nearer the unfailing end of this atrocious night, nearer the yet well-hidden goal for which we fight, the one unchanging dream for which we live, while we never forget, never forgive. And time rolls on, and every dreary hour that passes by into eternity glaringly shows the soundness of our claim and tells the world the inanity of thy enemy's victory, while bringing thy dismembered nation new strength and new prosperity, new hopes of unity with the increasing certainty of our return to power. And both our persecutors further fears of unavoidable annihilation. And thus we march invincibly towards our lofty aim along the way of blood and tears. It matters not what price we gave, it matters not what price we shall yet give to see all those who hated thee descend into the grave after they mourn under our whip for years and years. For we never forget, never forgive. That's one line I forgot. And time rolls on, and every passing second brings us nearer. I must say it again. That brings us nearer. I can't remember it. I have the whole poem. Brings us nearer to the passing second. No, I can't remember it. I can't remember. Two or three lines I can't remember. It's no good telling the rest. I'll say it again on another one when I get the paper and I'm reminded of it. I'll tell it again. And I would like you to put that new record on, only that poem, on the 8th of May. I have it in my room. I'll tell it on another record time. I'll be very frank on Christianity. I used to go to church. I'm christened in the Greek Orthodox Church. And I used to go to church until I was about 23, until I became conscious of being a National Socialist. In the church, the church was not really a church in those days. It was just a room in my native town. Now the Greeks of Lyon have a real church and a beautiful one. I go sometimes, I still go when I'm there. I used to go, but not because I loved the values of Christianity. I never could accept the values of Christianity. But I liked the church. I liked the church because it was national, supposed to be national at least. I had been told that for forever, the National Church of Greece is the Orthodox Church. The modern Greece is the daughter of Byzantium. It's the continuity of what was Byzantium once, what the Turks have destroyed. The Greek nationality would not be alive if it hadn't been for the church and for the monasteries under Turkish dominion for 400 years. And this given, and given also the beauty of Byzantine music and of Byzantine singing, I used to go to church and I liked it. And I like it still. But as far as the values of Christianity, that's a quite different thing. By the way, I really believe that a very great number of modern Greeks don't believe in the values of Christianity at all. Many might not even believe in the facts that they are celebrating, for instance, Easter, the resurrection, and things like that. If you really ask them, if they are sincere, they will tell you that the judge tells us so, but it seems rather queer to believe, rather difficult to believe. It doesn't matter. They attached to the church just because it is the national church. And one man whose life I took as a thema of my complementary, that is to say, second thesis of doctrine. My first thesis is on mathematical simplicity, it's a thesis of logics. The second one is on the life of Caeris, Theophilus Caeris, born in 1784, died in prison, 1853 in Greece, put to prison by the Greek government for not being a member, openly not believing in the Orthodox Church, the national church. And I put in parallel the theme of my thesis was not so much the person, Caeris, but the Greek mentality regarding religion, exactly the same as that of ancient Greece. Socrates was condemned. He does not believe in those gods in which the city believes. Had he not been an Athenian, nobody would have cared in Athens. Had he been an Egyptian, a Persian, something like that, a Syrian, nobody would have cared whether he believed in the gods of Greece at all. It was natural he should believe in his own gods. Every country had its own. And there was harmony between them all. They used to borrow each other's gods now and then when they really wanted the services of a god against illness or something like that. That was antiquity. That is modern Greece. No modern Greek would find it necessary to convert a Turk to Christianity. He's a Turk? Well, all right. A Turk is natural to be Mormon. He's a Frangos, means a man from West Europe. From Europe, in Greece, in modern Greek language, in current language, Europe means West Europe. Europe means what was influenced by the Roman Empire of the West. What was influenced by the Byzantine Empire, is just to say Greece, the Balkans, Russia. That's not Europe. That's something else. Well, in fact, if not geographically, at least ideologically, they are right. Greece is not Europe. No, it's Russia or the Balkans. And it's natural for a Western European to be a Protestant or a Catholic. And he's a foreigner, a Catholic, even a Greek Catholic is a foreigner. You can hear a Greek tell you, well, we have three foreigners in our building. There's a Catholic on the first floor, there's a Jew on the third floor, and there's an American on the ground floor. An American, a Jew, a Catholic, all foreigners. Well, this spirit I had myself as an adolescent, although it was not my father's spirit, my father was not a believer at all. He was christened, but he didn't believe. He was what they call a free thinker. My mother was a follower of the Church of England as an Englishwoman, but she was more and more and more going towards skepticism, agnosticism, as she grew older. In the end, she used to say, well, I don't know whether the soul exists or not, whether we have a soul or not. That's a metaphysical problem. It's beyond my comprehension. And what I had against Christianity from the very start was, first, that it was not national. It was not national. We had something before it in Greece. Why didn't we stick to that? We had something as beautiful and more beautiful than it. We had the worship of the sun. We had the worship of gods that represented natural forces. We had the worship of the forces of the universe. We were in harmony with the universe. and not with man. It was not man-centered. Our religions were not man-centered. No religions of the antiquity were man-centered. Except one. Judaism was not only man-centered, it was Jew-centered. The other religions were, of course, national, but at the same time, they were cosmic. Anything that has to do with sun worship or moon worship or worship of forces of nature is naturally cosmic. And the man of antiquity never thought anything of worshipping somebody else's gods. The Pharaoh, Amenhotep III, when he was sick, couldn't find any solace by the means of the god of medicine, god of healing of Egypt, Khons. Khons, son of Amon, and Mut. No. But he heard that Ishtar of Nineveh was good for healing. She had healing powers. He brought the statue of Ishtar of Nineveh 2,000 kilometers far away, brought it to Egypt. And it seemed that she cured him. She stayed 2 years in Egypt, and then she was sent back with her priest to Nineveh. That was the spirit of antiquity. Freedom. No intolerance at all. No lack of toleration. None of that thing. If you don't belong to us, you're damned. If you don't have our religion, our belief, you're damned. None of that in antiquity. None of that before Christianity. The Jews is quite a different thing. The Jewish religion is quite a different thing. The Jewish religion is national, tribal. Yahweh, Jehovah, is the God of the Jews. The Jews will not say, if you don't belong to Jehovah, you are damned. Oh no. Oh no. You are a Moabite, it's quite natural, you worship Chemosh. You are an Ammonite, you worship Milcom, quite natural. You are a Philistine, you worship Dagon, you worship somebody else, Philistine gods. But if you are in our path, if you are in our Betzirk, in our region, you must be destroyed. There's a place only for us. That's the Old Testament. I don't want to expatiate on that. I only ask those who don't believe me to open the Bible and read Deuteronomy chapter 7, the first verses of chapter 7. That's all in it. Now, I didn't like that very much. It has one advantage only. That is to say, it is forbidden for a Jew to marry a non-Jew. Not that the non-Jew is bad. Sometimes he does marry non-Jews. For instance, Mahalon, the son of Noemi, married Ruth. That was a Moabitess. And that very same Moabitess married Boaz. Boaz, the son of Rahab, of Jericho, who became celebrated. Well, Rahab herself was celebrated for keep taking in the Jewish spies of Joshua. Anyhow, they were taken in sometimes. Your God is my God, and your people will be my people, said Ruth to her mother-in-law, Noemi, when after the death of her husband, she followed Noemi to Judea. But it was an exception. Generally, it was forbidden for the Jews to take women in Canaan outside their own fold. Although racially they were the same. There was no difference between a Jew and a Canaanite, racially. But they were worshippers of different gods. And it was feared that they would entice the husbands to worship their gods. That was the great idea. In that way, of course, it kept the Jews among themselves. It was a good thing. From the racialist point of view. What I have against international religions, be it Christianity, be it Islam, the two religions that sprang from Judaism, be it even Buddhism, that sprang from an Aryan creed, is that they are international and that they have no objection to interracial marriages. In Buddhism, it's not generally done. You don't see an Indian Buddhist marry a Japanese Buddhist. Japanese Buddhists wouldn't like it anyhow. Japanese people are really racialist. But you can see Arabs with harems of women of all nationalities. The Arabs of Spain, the founders of the Caliphate of Cordova, well, they were no Arabs at all after the third generation. The very son of the conqueror of Spain, Musa al-Kibir, Abdelaziz is called, his son. Musa al-Kibir is the conqueror, the one who conquered Spain in the early 8th century. His son married a Visigoth woman, the widow of the last king of the Visigoths at Xeres. And his son married another Aryan, or partly Aryan. And his son, the same thing. After three generations or four, there was no Arab blood at all in the rulers of Cordova. And you get the same thing in other countries. You get intermarriages of Arabs and Negroes. Abyssinians are a mixture of the two. You get a mixture of Arabs and whatever not, anything that's Mohammedan. If you are a Mohammedan, you can marry any Mohammedan. And if you are a Christian, there is no reason why you shouldn't marry any Christian. According to the church, it's not forbidden. It's not forbidden at all. And I don't like that. I much prefer our old European religions, European or non-European, anyhow, all religions of antiquity, of that free antiquity of which Adolf Hitler speaks at the page 507 of Mein Kampf, the German edition of 1935, in which he says, the old ancient world that was much freer than it is today became unfree with the entrance of Christianity. He's perfectly right. You don't get persecution of religions for the religious sake in antiquity. You get persecutions for political reasons. That's quite different. Socrates was killed because he was an Athenian who did not believe in the gods of Athens. Now, some say that Christ himself was in reality, a fighter against the Romans, and that the Romans crucified him because he was against them, because he stirred trouble against them. As king of the Jews, but as a descendant of David and lawful king of the Jews. The truth is that if he had been condemned by the Jews for blasphemy, what was blasphemy according to the Jewish law, that is to say, calling himself Son of God, he would never have been crucified. The Jews didn't crucify them to crucify people, they used to stone them. And one was stoned for blasphemy, one was not crucified. Crucifixion was a Roman capital punishment for people who were not Roman citizens. Anyhow, that's not a point. Scholars have different opinions about the person of Christ. Whatever it is, the message, as it came down to us, the message attributed to Christ, whatever it is, that forgiveness of enemies, kindness to all men, but only to men. I mean, see, animals are never mentioned in the Gospels. The person that keeps it, that is at the center of the Gospel, whether it is the historic Christ or another one, or another person, invented by further commentators, especially Paul, it is a fact that no miracle is ever reported in favor of a creature that's not a human creature. On the contrary, you get a fig tree that refuses to give Christ some figs out of season. It's mentioned in Mark. The fig tree did not give figs, it was out of season. And Christ curses the poor fig tree, and the next day it's completely withered. For not giving his figs out of season, what did he expect him to do? Did he expect the fig tree to give him figs out of season? And if he was so powerful, why didn't he just ask the fig tree to do it and give him the fig tree the power to give figs out of season? There's something that used to shock me. That shocked me in Christianity. That fig tree withered, cursed by the founder of Christianity, because he wouldn't give figs out of season, against the laws of nature. And the poor Gadarene swine. Here is a pack of people possessed by devils. The devils won't get out of them. And they tell Christ, we will only get out if you allow us to go into the swine. There was a herd of swine. Well, first of all, what business had a man to have a herd of swine in Judah? Jews are not to eat any swine, any pig. What was he bringing up these swine for? What was he herding them for? To sell them to the Romans, I suppose. For people who used to eat pork, the Jews never eat pork. Anyhow, Christ allows these devils to enter this poor swine. They have done no harm to anybody. And they get, I mean to say, like mad, and they throw themselves into the Sea of Galilee from the cliff. I didn't like that. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but I didn't like that. So many things I never liked in Christianity. And then I discovered National Socialism, as I told you, in Palestine. I became conscious of being a National Socialist as I saw the amount of devotion of fellow Greeks to a land, the Holy Land, that was not Greece at all. And I thought that every person should have first devotion to his own land. And slowly I found out, in spite of the propaganda, the National Socialist propaganda, very opportunist propaganda, saying we have nothing against Christianity. That we have nothing against Christianity, that always shocked me. We are Christians, very good Christians, that always shocked me. The one thing that I underlined when I read the 25 points for the first time, 25 points that are the basis of National Socialism, for the public at least. Point 4, 24. We stand for a positive type of Christianity. We stand by positive Christianity. What does the Führer mean by positive Christianity? Probably aid one another. When all the institutions like the NSV, the Winter Aid, the Aid to Mother and Child, all these things represent what the public can consider as positive Christianity. Love your neighbor, all right. And then comes the end of point 24. The party is neutral in matters of religion. We admit any kind of religion, provided it does not shock the moral feelings of the German race and does not go against the state. Well, I thought of this and I said to myself, a religion that allows marriage with view to reproduction between an Aryan and a non-Aryan, provided they are both christened in the same church, is naturally against the moral feelings of the Germanic people and against the interest of the state. And Christianity is one of these religions. A Catholic Negro can marry a Catholic of any country, including a Catholic German. Why not? They're both Catholics. I knew a couple, a mixed couple like that. The woman, a beautiful woman, young, blue-eyed, blonde, Aryan, the daughter of a German soldier of the First World War, and of an Alsatian woman, unmarried, doesn't make any difference, an Aryan. She met in some ballroom in Lyon, my native town, a perfectly brown, dark brown Dravidian of South India, considered by other Indians of upper caste as an untouchable. And he was a Catholic, and she was a Catholic, and the two married, and they had four children, three sons and a daughter. Fortunately, the children are not married. I hope they never marry. They were very happy together, it seems. The man was not bad, I have nothing against him, but I would have liked him to marry a Dravidian untouchable, a Dravidian Harijana, they call him, like himself. And she should have married a Frenchman, an Alsatian, or a German. She was a German herself. But because they were Catholics, they got married. If they had not been Christians at all, if he had been the worshipper of Mariamma, Mariamma is the mother goddess of South India, one of the numerous mother goddesses of South India. Supposing he had been that, nothing else, worshipper of Mariamma, And she, a worshipper of Wotan, like in antiquity. They never would have come together. There you are. That is the advantage of these national creeds. They keep you each one in its place. And when they don't, well, it's an exception. Or else the two people are very near each other. You had, for instance, probably intermarriages between people who worshipped Tor in antiquity and Slavs. How did the Poles come? Poles are Slavs with a mixture of German. They're not pure Slav. And so many Russians are not pure Slav either. The Russians, the ancestors of the Russians before Christianity, they worshipped another one with a hammer also and four heads, Perun. Perun and Tor got on very well together. They were neighbors. They symbolized the same thing. Well, why not? They were brothers. They were very near in race. And of course, you had these Gauls marrying Germans in the Merovingian days. Before the Gauls became Christians, they had their own gods. They had some international gods, cosmic gods, the sun and the moon, naturally. The sun and the moon. There's a lovely little dialogue in a French tale, short story of Anatole France. Oh, was it Anatole France? Yes, Anatole France. Of a Gaul that followed Caesar to England. And they're both coming back. And the Gaul saw with his own eyes the shattering to pieces of the Roman fleet and the coast of England due to tide. And he knows the moon governs the tide. And he tells Caesar on his way back,